The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
Coming up on Columbia Calling with me, your host Richard McCall. We're here in Mompox, Colombia for a change. We're not in Bogota. And we'll be talking about Gabriel Garcia Marquez, a little bit about his legacy. And of course, we're in mourning here on Columbia Calling because this literary great has left this world. So we'll be talking first about Gabriel Garcia Marquez and then to Wesley Tomaselli, a US journalist based here in Colombia, making his life and determined to write interesting, more investigated and descriptive pieces about Colombia rather than just the disaster pieces that we so often read in the mainstream press. So don't go away, tune in to Columbia Calling with me, your host Richard McCall. That's ColumbiaCallingRadio.com later on today. Thank you.
The world is a beautiful place, so listen up. The Overseas Radio Network.
We know you want to grow your business and directly engage your customers and clientele. Podcasting is the way to go, and Podfly has your solution. Whether you're a blogger, writer, business owner, entrepreneur, or service provider, Podfly makes it easy for anyone to have a professionally produced and distributed podcast. Get started today at podfly.net, and let's get your message truly heard. Podfly.net, passion for great-sounding podcasts.
Ready to learn about a new life overseas? You're at the right place. This is the Overseas Radio Network.
This is Columbia Calling. I'm your host, Richard McCall, here in Colombia. At the moment, I'm in hot and sweaty Mompox, so I'm 6 hours south of Cartagena, and we've just come out of Easter week. That's Semana Santa here in Mompox, Colombia. It's a very austere, very chaotic Semana Santa with processions that last all night long, where the pilgrims, who are people of the region, you know, the humble people of the region, they are Nazarenes. They put on dark, heavy tunics and the sort of masks that look like clan member masks but are purple, and they come out in this 40 degree heat carrying the floats of the whole of the Last Supper, but walking 3 paces forward and 2 paces back. So processions last from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m. And if you could imagine that all taking place in a perfectly preserved, so authentic colonial town, that's what you have here during Semana Santa in Mompox. This is where I have my little hotel, La Casa Maria, and of course we've been enjoying a bumper week of full of, we've had Germans and French and Colombians and Americans and, I mean, from everywhere in fact, Ecuadorians, anyway, but we were all moved, of course, with the big and the tragic news of last week was that the passing of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. That's Colombia's Nobel laureate for literature. He won the Nobel Prize in 1987. Everyone out there will have read articles, obituaries, and indeed, hopefully, will have read many of his works of literature and journalism. And yes, here at Columbia Calling, we were, you know, I've been writing a lot about the gentleman since I've been here in Colombia, about Gabo and Gaba, his wife, and being here in Mompox, which, you know, sort of brings me around nicely because Mompox being isolated and the perceived difficulty of this town, it could be said to resemble the Macondo of 100 years of solitude. This is an authentic, forgotten colonial town where as a Canadian, a Colombo-Canadian documentary maker once said, this is the town where weird shit happens. So anyway, yes, so we, you know, it was taken hard in this region. And if you think that only 5 hours or 4 hours north of here is actually his birthplace of Aracataca. Should you want to hear more about Aracataca, I recommend to you then to look back through the files on iTunes and check out the podcast with Tim Buendia, a Dutchman. He's actually, his name is Tim Antkoor, but he's a Dutchman who made a home and a business in Aracataca. And unfortunately, the business became unsustainable economically. It was not economically viable in Gabriel Garcia Marquez's hometown of Aracataca just due to corruption and political indifference. So, yes, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, take a moment and think about what you've read, what you need to read. That's 100 Years of Solitude, Love in the Time of the Cholera, Nobody Writes to the Colonel, The General in His Labyrinth, perhaps the greatest, the most misunderstood novel because it's a historical novel. And then, of course, News of a Kidnapping, which is straight-up journalism, really detailing the dreadful times in the 80s and early 90s in Colombia when kidnapping was a major industry for illegal gangs, illegal groups, the FARC, the paramilitaries, the ELN, whomever. What else? I mean, the Autumn of the Patriarch. I mean, you could go on and on and on. When, you know, his journalism, when he was in exile, when he went to France, when he was... I mean, he self-exiled off into Mexico because there was the issue that the government of Turbay was planning on questioning him for links or friendships with the EPL guerrilla group, that's the Ejército de Popular Liberación. And so, you know, he self-exiled for more than 30 years. Gabo had been living in Mexico and had been treated as a Mexican. And he had strong ties with Fidel Castro and owned a house near to Fidel there in Cuba. That's been a source of much debate after a conservative congresswoman tweeted a comment about how Fidel and Gabo will be in hell together soon. So that was pretty controversial. And I think, frankly, we shouldn't get involved in these sort of things. We need to reflect on his literature and on the mark that he left as a literary giant and as a spokesperson for Colombia in terms of literature and his art. So, you know, hats off to Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Colombia's Nobel Prize-winning laureate. A sad loss, but we knew he was unwell. It had been coming. He was suffering from dementia. His lymphatic cancer hadn't completely gone away. The problems that had manifested themselves recently in his urinary tract and in his lungs did seem to be like a warning. And I got the impression when he was released on sort of April 8th from the hospital in Mexico that indeed he was being allowed home to die amongst his family, to pass away with his family. So here in Colombia Calling, we are, you know, in mourning, say that in the most profound sense of it all, because Gabriel Garcia Marquez has gone but will live on through his literature, through his words, his prose, his journalism, and his personality, because of course he was larger than life, despite in the last few years making very few public appearances. I was fortunate enough to see him speak at the Congress of the Spanish Language in Cartagena in 2007, so that was a real honor to hear him talking about 100 Years of Solitude and the Nobel Prize there in Cartagena, in what could be his sort of second home, because he had a house there, and the house is actually pretty much alongside the Santa Clara Hotel if you're in Cartagena. So we'll be coming back in after the break with someone who's a really up and coming journalist. I don't like saying that term, but moving from one fabulous journalist to another one. So we'll be coming back to talk to Wesley Tomaselli, a New York journalist who has made his home in Colombia and has some very interesting points of view on the situations in Colombia and how he sees his writing and what he would like to do with his writing. So don't go away, we'll be coming straight back with Wesley Tomaselli. I'm Richard McCall, this is Colombia Calling.
OverseasRadio.com, broadcasting from Panama to Paris and beyond.
You've got questions about Columbia, and Escape Artist has answers. Is Columbia a good fit for me and my plans? How do I buy a house? Find a job? Find a doctor? Start a business? Invest in real estate? What should I know to better appreciate its history, its culture, its opportunities? What is it really like to be an expat in Colombia? You'll find your answers at columbia.escapeartist.com, your complete and trusted guide for living, working, playing, investing, and retiring in Colombia. That's columbia.escapeartist.com.
You're listening to the Overseas Radio Network, the exclusive online radio station for the expatriate community.
And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. And as always, we have a very special guest with us this week. And we'd like to have our interviews here in person, here in Bogota. And we're talking to Wesley Tomaselli, who's a journalist from the United States. He's from a small town in New York State, and he's a financial and energy reporter. But we're going to talk about a bit of everything with Wesley, because, you know, he's a guy who's clued up and clued in and plugged in, and he's got his own website. He's been here for a couple of years. So, Wesley, welcome.
Thanks, Richard. Really excited. Really excited to be here.
All right, that's a pleasure. Now, Wesley, we met in Mompox. You actually came through the Casa Maria, my little venture there, and we got to talking and so on and so forth. Now, I know that you came to Colombia in 2009 the first time, and it led you to come back. And you've been here for 2 years now, full time. What happened?
Yeah, what did happen? Well, so in 2009, I came to Medellin as a student, actually, as a university student. And it was one of those exchange programs. Uh-huh. This was called AIESEC, A-I-E-S-E-C. A student-run non-for-profit that sort of, you know, facilitates exchange between countries. It's almost like a model UN. I came as a sort of ambassador of the United States, but being a university student, kind of the taste of Colombia I got in 2009 in those 2 months was, you know, lots of parties. Hanging out with students. It was sort of that ideal picture of Colombia that gets sold a lot abroad, but it wasn't really it was kind of a superficial taste. So that was 2009. I met a lot of people though, and I made a lot of friends. Mm-hmm. And when I decided to go abroad again, I took Colombia pretty seriously because I had a really good friend here in Bogota, a guy I had met in 2009. And so knowing that he was here and finding a really good English professorship here with an institute, I decided on Bogota. And as you know, Bogota is not Medellin.
No, it's not.
but it was a great opportunity in terms of the work experience. I had a really good friend here, and I really wanted to learn Spanish. I wanted to take my exchange much more seriously this time. So, what really attracted me is, you know, the idea of Spanish classes in a city where Castellano is probably the most pure classical, at least according to a lot of people. So, that's what kind of took me back. I didn't think I'd stay, though.
That's pretty cool. So now, in Medellin, your exchange program was through your university, and you know, it's not-for-profit and so on. Which university did you study at in the United States?
I studied at Cornell University.
Oh, very nice. So in upstate New York as well. And so,
yeah.
So you're very much from the state of New York.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing is, I mean, being from upstate New York, from a really small town where, you know, my town was, I think, 3,000 people and mostly dairy farmers. You know, going to school there wasn't a huge cultural change. Cornell as a university is very diverse, but I really had the urge to sort of get out.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Now, you were in Medellin, and I believe you spent some time with Columbia Reports, who the director we've had here on the show, Adrian Anselmo, controversial.
Controversial, total character, but a really close friend of mine and an extraordinary mentor, really. He really taught me how to do journalism, actually. and a really close friend. But yeah, so fast forward from those kind of early months teaching English here in Bogota, I sort of had this dream to become a foreign correspondent, and really did not expect to even kind of dig my feet in anytime soon in Colombia. Colombia was to me at that point in time a conflict country, a place where journalism is very dangerous, and you know, just not the place where I really thought I wanted to learn journalism.
Yeah.
But you know what? I met this girl named Amy Lieberman, who was a freelance correspondent. She's no longer here in Bogota, but I met her and I said, "Yo, I want to do what
you
do." And she was covering a lot of the really like gnarly stuff, Richard. She was covering like a lot of human rights issues, child soldiers. It was a failed story, but she told me about a time that she, a story took her into the southwestern part of Colombia, really rebel hotbed, and to go to this, I think, gold mine, she had to, like, embed with indigenous warriors. I mean, it was just, she was covering really crazy stuff. But I said, "Hey, I really want to do what you want to do, or what you're doing." And so she put me in touch with Adrian, and she said, "You got to get clips, and Columbia Reports is a great way to do it because they'll train you." So I got in touch with Adrian. We did a story together in November of 2012, and in 2013 I did an internship with him, and that was sort of my, like, you know, let's say, launch pad. He taught me how to do journalism, and I started building clips, and I started freelancing and pitching later in the year.
Excellent. Now, that's a real success story, but you've gone around about it the right way. You've got the experience. You're working alongside as an English teacher to, you know, make ends meet, because you and I both know that journalism doesn't pay. Yeah. Hopefully, one somewhere down the line it will. But I mean, fantastic success story on your part to, you know, really tough it out, and basically you've jumped headlong into one of the most sort of tenacious businesses here in Colombia, maybe worldwide. Yeah. So this is excellent work. And now you're writing about, sort of, let's say, financial and energy. Sort of, you're doing energy reporting, and what are the key stories that you would say at the present time that are going on in Colombia?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. Right now, I'm doing a lot of energy reporting, and one of the big stories that's happening right now is what's going on in the eastern part of the country, in these two provinces. One is the Arauca department, and one is the Norte de Santander. These are two provinces that border Venezuela, and there's this, what probably a lot of people don't know, is that there's this massive, massive pipeline that runs from Colombia's interior along the Venezuelan coast all the way out to the Caribbean coast and to a port called Covenas. The pipeline is called Caño Limón-Covenas. And the Caño Limón is this big oil field that Occidental Petroleum, a company based in Los Angeles, has owned and operated for, together with Ecopetrol, I think they own it 100% now, for a while. Ecopetrol owns the pipeline, and this pipeline has been bombed like crazy by rebel groups. Most of the time, it's always hard to figure out who these guys are, if it's the FARC or the ELN. Sometimes, you know, sometimes paramilitary groups steal oil right out, like draw a tap and steal it out of the tap. But most of the time it's the ELN, the second largest rebel group. So this is a really big story, not just because it's been getting bombed a lot, Richard, but Occidental Petroleum just fired 500 workers in Arauca because the production is just getting hit so hard. And of course, in turn, these workers are saying, "Well, hey, you're violating our workers' contracts," which are indefinite, and you know, you have to at least follow through on the benefits. So it's another one of these, you know, it's not by far not the first time it's happened, but it's another one of these cases where a multinational has terminated contracts due to, you know, a significant super severe event, and workers suffer, and the workers look like they're rallying to protest.
Now, I mean, this is a very serious story. 500 people lose their jobs because a multinational decides that, you know, the production is being hampered so severely by rebel groups. And I do, yeah, it's in the main, and for the most part, the ELN. And of course, the bombing of this pipeline is creating huge environmental damage.
Totally.
And the ELN is also part of their sort of whole fundamental is that we care for the environment. So there's a kind of duplicitous nature of all this. But I don't know. It's a very tough one. I think we're going to come back to this in the next segment of the show, because I think there's a lot more to talk about regarding what's going on that perhaps we don't read or hear about in the mainstream press. So I'm talking to Wesley Tomaselli, a US journalist here in Bogota. I'm Richard McCall, and this is Columbia Calling. Don't go away.
Pack your bags and explore the world with us. You're listening to the Overseas Radio Network.
This is Kathleen Petticord and Leif Simon with the Live and Invest Overseas Minute on the Overseas Radio Network. Are you looking to rent overseas? Before you log online, here are some tips that can save you a lot of time and help ensure that you get the best deal possible on your rental wherever in the world you're looking to live.
So finding an apartment to rent overseas should be done at the local level. Looking on the internet, you're going to find English advertisements that are easier to find a rental for you, but those are going to be priced for the foreign market. To get to the local market, you want to get your feet on the ground and take a look.
Exactly. To get a good deal, you've got to shop beyond the internet market. And to do that, you've got to have your feet on the ground, either yours or those of a reliable local contact you trust. And you should enlist the help of an attorney to review the rental contract.
Also, you need to keep in mind that the local contract needs to be in the local language to be legal. So you'll want an English language translation, but you're going to have to sign a local language contract, especially in the Latin American countries.
For more information on making the leap overseas, visit us online at liveandinvestoverseas.com.
You're tuned in to OverseasRadio.com, the station to help you reach your dream destination.
And we're back. This is Columbia Calling with me, your host, Richard McCall. I'm here with Wesley Tomaselli, a U.S. journalist who works in the energy sector and the finance sector and so on. But we've just been talking about something really serious taking place in the, let's say, the outer-lying provinces, departments, as they're known here in Colombia. So Arauca, Norte de Santander, I'm sure Casanare is affected on some level. But we're talking about this pipeline. It's an oil pipeline taking this huge, I don't even know how many barrels of oil per day supposedly out of these huge fields. Anyway, Wesley's been telling me that it's getting bombed so much that production is being hampered to such an extent that, is it Occidental Oil? Occidental Oil has...
Occidental Petroleum, yeah.
Has had to cut 500 jobs just because of this. And of course, they're infringing on workers' rights, and there's going to be all sorts of strikes. And this is because of the bomb attacks, you know, inflicted by the guerrillas on this infrastructure. And it's just things that we don't hear about. We're in Bogota, and we're in this... I mean, we're in this tiny sort of molehill, let's almost say in the middle of the country, and nothing else happens outside of it. You know, we can read the press here, and there might be a little report about it, but it's not giving us the reasons why this is happening. So just tell us a bit more about what's going on, Wesley.
Yeah, so, I mean, in this, I find this really fascinating. By far, I don't really have all the answers, but, you asked a good question. Why is this happening? Why is this pipeline getting attacked like mad? Why is a rebel group that has, said vouches for indigenous groups, at the same time causing environmental destruction in the territories where those indigenous groups live? Because that's really the collateral damage. Mm-hmm. isn't suffered by anyone other than the people who live in these places. Mm-hmm. So I think the why question is a really good one. One thing I can say is that the ELN and, to an extent, the FARC, the FARC being the largest guerrilla group, have kind of shifted in the last, decade or so, their sort of strategy from, the horrors of civilian kidnappings and extortion and, bombing of nightclubs, to declaring war on the energy sector. And I think it's kind of my impression, again, this is just my impression, is that it's a political strategy. They're sitting in Havana at the negotiating table with the Colombian government, and they're at the same time, and they've said, we're going to stop kidnapping, we're going to stop all this gruesome stuff that we've done in the past. Oh, but by the way, we didn't tell you, we're going to declare war on your economy. This pipeline is like a jugular vein of the economy. And so to me, it's almost like, hey, we want to talk to you, but we've got a knife to your back. And so, I don't know, that's my impression of the why. Because there've definitely been an uptick in attacks over the last several years,
and they're going to increase. I mean, this is what's been reported, that the people assume, you know, indications show that these attacks on the pipeline will increase in the run up to the elections in May 25th, I believe, the election. So, I mean, how much more can, you know, Occidental Petroleum take of this sort of attacks?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't have a good sense of how much more it can take. But what I think, you know, we can say fairly at this point is that these major oil companies and energy companies that are operating in Colombia are taking a really hard hit. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that should be highlighted is it's not just the company's bottom lines that are taking a hit. It's workers, it's the environment, it's indigenous groups who have inhabited these areas for a long time, where the attacks are taking place. They're taking a really hard hit too, because they endure the collateral damage.
Of course, no, and it's an incredibly sad story that's taking place out in these outer lying areas, and the difference, as we always talk, I mean, I managed to slide this in every show, is that the difference between rural Colombia and urban Colombia is I mean, extreme. Nothing happens, you know, but I have to ask, as we're here, we've been talking about topical issues and the oleoductos or the pipeline. We've got the elections on May 25th. How do you think they're going to pan out?
Oh, man. I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I'll have to be honest. I don't stay as connected to all of the political drama as maybe intensely as I would if I were reporting on it more.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not going to make a prediction about who wins or take a stab at that, because I just don't think I have the background for it. But here's what I will say. I do think that between, you know, what's been happening in Arauca and Norte de Santander, where the pipeline is located, together with some really deep-seated unrest in the agricultural sector, and a really strong willingness, a lot of rhetoric coming from the campesinos, the farmers, to return to their paro agrario, which is an agriculture strike at the end of April. I mean, I just see a lot of kind of external pressures, waves kind of chopping at the hull of the election. And I really hope that in the midst of all that, voters don't lose focus on what the real issues are here. I think the peace deal is a real issue that often gets sort of distracted from by other drama. I think that security and like urban crime, security in rural areas is a major issue. But I also think that the economy is a big issue. I mean, oil reserves are expected to run out in 8 years.
Of course.
So what are the not just the promises, but the real hard plans that candidates are going to be. The candidates are going to talk about in the run-up to the election, that deal with the the economy? You know, that's what I'm curious about.
It's interesting. It's interesting. This the obviously, and of course, you report on economic issues, financial issues, energy issues. Of course, this is your beat. This is what this is what you know. I've been trying to find sort of campaign promises, or let's say, you know, some sort of manifesto for the, let's just say you take Juan Manuel Santos, the president, yeah. You take Oscar Iván Zuluaga for the Central Democráticos, the right-wing group, you've got Peñalosa for those in the center, left of center, and then beyond that there's a whole sort of mishmash of liberals, yeah. And Polo Democrático and everything. But I haven't found a manifesto. I haven't found anyone who's actually out there, saying, listen, this is what we plan, it's about education, or this is what we plan, it's the economy. You know, that, you know, when we watch, let's say, the elections in the US, or we watch elections in the UK, the electorate have an idea. They have this thing, it's like, okay, Obama saying, or whoever, or Clinton saying, it's education, or you've got Blair saying education, yeah. Education, where whomever is saying it. I might have got some things mixed up, because that's the way it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But here, there's nothing. It's all about peace or war, basically. I don't know how to...
Well, I think the war peace conversation really does cloud a lot of these other finer issues. But you know, the other thing I think clouds the real issues, Richard, is Colombia seems to survive on this. This sort of climate of personality politics.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, one thing that really struck me as being somewhat particular is in the run-up to elections, Alvaro Uribe, the ex-president
the puppet master.
Alvaro Uribe, who was president before Santos, sort of led this whole campaign with the party that supports him and that he supports, Centro Democrático, trying to associate his personality with the party instead of ideals.
Mm-hmm.
And promises with the party. So it was almost like a way of telling voters, at least my read on it was, it was a way of telling voters, vote this party and vote my personality, because my personality is behind this party, instead of a message that says to the electorate, vote this party and vote A, B, C ideals, for example, security, a stronger agricultural sector, etc. And so, when you talk to Colombians, I'd like to know if you agree. when you talk to Colombians, it seems as though they get really involved in the personalities of these leaders, and don't really see beyond that. And I think that's an unfair. I think that's unfair, and I hope it doesn't cloud the upcoming election.
It's interesting you said that. I was in hospital some weeks ago. I ended up talking to a doctor who was attending to a dog bite in my hand. Anyway.
Oh, I read about that in the blog. So sorry.
It's all right. It's eating well. But,
it's eating well again.
But as I said, and I remember asking, I said, so if you're thinking about the elections, you know, and you're thinking about healthcare, who would you vote for? And he said, no, in Colombia here, we don't have that. We don't have that sort of level of education to be able to vote for principles or vote for systems. It's all up. He said exactly what you said. It's a personality election.
Wow.
So we pick all that. And also it's historical. Your family's liberal, you're liberal. If your family's conservative, you're conservative.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're going to move on. We're going to close this section down. And next section, we're going to talk more anecdotally about your journalism. So I'm Richard McCall, and we're talking to Wesley Tomaselli, and this is Columbia Calling. Please don't go away.
Your expatriation destination. This is OverseasRadio.com.
Worried about rising taxes, costly insurance, out-of-control healthcare, economic decline, staggering debt, mortgages, and retirement? It doesn't have to be this way. Escape to Ecuador, one of the most beautiful countries on the planet, and at EcuadorAtYourService.com, be your guide. Ecuador has been named the number one retirement destination in the world 3 times in a row. So if you're searching for beaches, jungles, farmland, cities, affordable health care, and a richer lifestyle at half the cost, contact EcuadorAtYourService.com.
Searching for freedom? The sustainable community in Chile is found at FreedomOrchard.com. Quiet, peaceful, and pristine are some of Freedom Orchard's outstanding features. Freedom Orchard offers recreational activities, organic farming, and self-sufficiency for water and electricity. Well-known Chile expert, free market economist, and radio host of Red Hot Chile, Dr. John Coben, is heading a team of developers, organic farmers, and seasoned professionals to make Freedom Orchard a reality. FreedomOrchard.com, for when you're serious about your freedom.
Sit back and relax. You are tuned into the Overseas Radio Network.
We're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl. We're talking to Wesley Tomaselli, a U.S. journalist. I just want to promote his website, which you should all look at, definitely. It's WesleyTomaselli.com. So that's WesleyTomaselli.com. And so you can see his work, his writing up on there. And well, that leads me quite nicely. It feathers into the fact that he writes for something called the Beacon Reader. And you can look that up. It's at www.beaconreader.com. Now, Wes is going to explain a little bit about that and how he gets his anecdotes, he profiles people on that in Colombia. So, Wesley, tell us about this.
Yeah, so I'm actually really excited about this project, because when I'm not reporting on pipelines and
bombs
and energy and more of the dry financial stuff, I put a lot of my time and energy into Beacon. And Beacon is this relatively new digital publication. It sort of behaves like a magazine. But what's different about, what sets it apart from a traditional magazine is it allows readers to connect directly to writers and fund them. Okay. And so your subscription goes directly into the pockets of the writer who you choose to fund or subscribe to. It's kind of cool. It's kind of like a collection of columns or blogs. Everyone has a kind of a formal video pitch. And the project that I pitch and that I'm working on right now is profiling life in Colombia beyond the violence. Because what I think is really infecting traditional media these days, and tell me if you agree, is, outside of Colombia, audiences suffer from this, kind of storm of information that deals with the conflict and kidnappings and pipeline bombings. And, it kind of paints this picture of a people who are just totally mired in war. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that the conflict is unimportant, but what I do think is important to say is there's more to Colombia than just the history of violence and drug trafficking. Mm-hmm. So I go after people like musicians and graffiti artists and dig into their lives and profile them. Mm-hmm. And it's led me to meet some really interesting people.
This is kind of like almost like, I would say, pay-per-view writing.
It is. People have kind of equated.
Yeah, right. So tell us about some of the interviews, some of the profiles.
Yeah. Well, the most recent subject and the most recent story is about this graffiti artist named Marcel Marentes. He goes by his street name is Vogel, and he's a graffiti artist. Marcel has a studio down in the Palermo called Orfanato Studio, or Orfanato Studio. Orfanato is the word for orphan. Mm-hmm. And this guy just really struck me the first time I met him, because I was actually hanging out in the Septima and bumped into this. The way I met him was kind of funny. I was hanging out in the Septima and bumped into this girl who was painting graffiti. Yeah. And I saw her, and she was like this young, slender, 18-something-year-old girl. And I was just thinking, she's not a badass graffiti artist. Come on, you know? So I went up to her and talked to her, and, you know, she totally ripped to shreds the stereotype I had in my mind of this, you know, rebellious, punk, hard-ass graffiti artist. So I chatted with her a little bit because I like meeting people. But when I bumped into Marcel, I had no idea he was a graffiti artist. I was in his design shop, and I thought he was another client, actually. And he asked me, you know, what do you do? And I was telling him about this beacon project, and I said, you know, actually, I just met this graffiti artist. And, you know, wouldn't you think that a graffiti artist would be, like, some punk, hard-ass, you know, rebellious type?
Rings in the nose.
Yeah, totally. And he's kind of staring me down, you know? Yeah. He's staring me down as though, like, what is this guy talking about? And I said, she was just a little girl.
Uh-huh.
And, a person across the room said to me, you do know you're talking to probably one of the most respected graffiti artists in Bogota, right? And I looked at him, and he just kind of smiled, and he introduced himself, and I felt like a bit of an ass, but you know what? It was really cool, Richard, because he invited me right into his studio, and we sat down, we chatted, and we had a couple of other conversations after that, and he took me painting, and this guy's not a hoodlum, he's an artist, you know? And I think what's one of the really cool things about this Beacon project is it lets me find people like this and share their, like, more of the intimate details of who this person is behind the mask, behind the graffiti mask, or behind the, you know, I suffered from the conflict mask, and really show my audience, who's mostly, you know, people abroad who don't know a lot about Colombia beyond the violence, who these people are. And this guy just proved to be remarkably philosophical. I mean, ex-hardcore Marxist,
yeah.
But, you know, totally looks at the rebel groups as leftist rebel groups as another mafia. You know, really just pure, determined, with convictions, a guy who does art not to, not for reasons to become a superstar underground dude, but just to do art in the way he sees it should be.
But it must be socially motivated then, if you're talking about this former Marxist and so on and so.
Totally. So what's really interesting is when you talk to him and you ask him, you know, what drives you, what fuels you. You know, it's very, his stuff is very political, but it's also very metaphorical, which, I mean, I'm sure you've seen guys around Bogota doing, you know, their street art is, you know, it's saying something, but it's not there apparent. You know, he's very, very motivated by sort of the, let's say, the noise that a Colombian endures living in a conflict country. Marcel's a guy who grew up in middle class, very like rock solid middle class Bogota. Mm-hmm. He's not a displaced campesino or someone who grew up in the streets of Buenaventura. Mm-hmm. But the television has fed him nothing but stories of war and conflict for his 35 years. So a lot of his stuff is very political, but you got to peel back the layers to really find it.
So you get, I mean, so clearly with this Beacon, let's say it's Beacon Reader project that you've got, so that's www.beaconreader.com, clearly you get around, so you've talked to this, you know, this very respected graffiti artist. Have you been out there and talked to, like, with campesinos? I mean, we mentioned this earlier in the interview, but have you, anyone out in rural Colombia that you've spoken with?
Well, I can't say that I've profiled a campesino who's really, you know, out there, harvesting potatoes or, you know, working the fields. But one of the interesting things about living in Bogota is to some extent, you've got to be careful about how you interpret it, because it is an urban reality, but the countryside kind of comes to you. And so I have spoken with and profiled a, it was more of a personal essay, but profiled a a potato farmer named Benjamin Morales. Mm-hmm. That it was actually during the protests of August.
Oh, really?
I met this guy who had spent like 2 hours getting to Plaza Simón Bolívar. He's from Ciudad Bolívar, mm-hmm. The rural part outside of beyond the mega slum in the south of Bogota. And he was there protesting agricultural policy in August. I also profiled a guy who is a recycler, one of these guys that recycles trash on the streets of Bogota. You see them everywhere pulling their carts, who was from Huila province, and, you know, came from a poor farming background. So, I mean, I haven't been out there in the country, but I've definitely met some of these more disenfranchised or if not disenfranchised, people with from rural backgrounds. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a totally different reality. It's just such a clash with the urban cosmopolitan Bogota.
Well, that's it. I mean, we're drinking our cocktails here in Chapinero, and then, you know, the realities of a potato farmer in Tunja or somewhere like that. But you'll probably have to do your profiles on April 28th during the strikes then, because it looks like they're going to happen.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. And it's concerning. But, you know, I can be sort of sympathetic because I'm not a cosmopolitan guy, you know, even though it's one of the things that really fascinates me about Colombia, because I'm from a small town. I tell people, soy de un pueblito, I'm from a small town, because they hear the word New York and they think, oh, you're from the big city, the Big Apple. And I tell them, no, like I came from a town of 3,000. I think what's so remarkable is you can be from a country like the United States and come from a small town of 3,000 and come from a middle class economic reality. Mm-hmm. Here in Colombia, it's really hard to find someone who's from a pueblito of 3,000 who comes from a middle class reality where they can, you know, and when I say that, I mean they can cover their children's costs of education. They can save every month. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really different reality in the countryside.
It is very much so. And well, listen, if we need to, we'll do you a nice plug here. So listen, if you've been interested by what Wesley's talking about, check him out on the www.beaconreader.com, because then you can sign up and you know, basically sponsor him to continue writing, because we're all in that kind of situation at the moment.
Yeah, and what's really cool is you spend $5 a month sponsoring a writer like myself or another writer on Beacon, and that actually stretches a really long way in a place like Colombia. But what's really cool is your $5 a month also gets you access to all the writers on Beacon. It's a growing platform. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of really cool talent and investment behind it, based in the Bay Area. And the writers range from environmental journalists to far-flung correspondents based in Africa. Really cool group of people and writers and storytellers.
So interesting, extroverted, let's say, you know, a group, because you're covering everything. Well, Wesley, I'd like to say thank you for being on the show. We've covered a real breadth of subjects. You know, that's what we're here to inform. We're here to keep people interested in Colombia. And again, I'll plug your website, which is wesleytomaselli.com. If you don't understand how to spell it, check out our website, because the link will be up there. That's columbiacallingradio.com. Send us a tweet at Columbia Calling. You know, you can get in touch through the website if you think that someone's been missed out or we should be interviewing someone. But this week we've been talking to Wesley Tomaselli of New York State. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I'm Richard McCall. This is Columbia Calling. I hope you've enjoyed the show. And tune back in next week.
Live call-in shows and hosts from your favorite countries. This is the Overseas Radio Network.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast. So you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.